Top of the seventh. As twilight thickened toward true dark, Tricia came to a rocky open place that looked out over a small, blue-shadowed valley. She surveyed this valley eagerly, hoping to see lights, but there were none. A loon cried from somewhere, and a crow called crossly back. That was all. She looked around and saw several low rock outcrops with drifts of pine needles lying between them like hammocks. Tricia put her pack down at the head of one of these, went to the nearest stand of pine, and broke off enough boughs to make a mattress. It would hardly be a certa-perfect sleeper, but she thought it would do. The coming dark had brought on now familiar feelings of loneliness and sorrowful homesickness. But the worst of her terror was gone. Her sense of being watched had slipped away. If there really was a thing in the woods, it had gone off and left her to herself again. Tricia went back to the stream, knelt, drank. She had had little stomach cramps off and on all day, but she thought her body was adapting to the water nevertheless.
No problem with the nuts and berries either, she said, then smiled. Except for a few bad dreams and such.
She went back to her pack and her makeshift bed, got her Walkman, and settled the earbuds into place. A breeze puffed by her, cold enough to chill her sweaty skin and make her shiver. Tricia dug out the ruins of her poncho and fluffed the dirty blue plastic over her like a blanket. Not much in the way of warmth, but this was one of Mom's. It's the thought that counts. She pushed the power button on the Walkman, but although she hadn't changed the tuner setting, tonight she got nothing but wavers of faint static. She had lost WCAS. Tricia worked her way across the FM dial. She got a faint classical music up around 95 and a Bible thumper yelling about salvation at 99. Tricia was very interested in salvation, but not the kind the guy on the radio was talking about. The only help from the Lord she wanted right now was a helicopter filled with friendly, waving people. She tuned further, got Celine Dion loud and clear at 104, hesitated, then kept on rolling the tuner. She wanted the Red Sox tonight, Joe and Troop, not Celine singing about how her heart would go on and on. No baseball on the FM, in fact, nothing else at all. Tricia switched to the AM band and tuned up toward 850, which was WEEI in Boston. EEI was the Red Sox flagship station. She didn't expect perfect reception or anything, but she was hopeful. You could pick up a lot of AM at night, and EEI had a strong signal. It would probably waver in and out, but she could put up with that. She didn't have a lot else to do tonight. No hot dates or anything. EEI's reception was good. Clear as a bell, in fact. But Joe and Troop weren't on. In their place was one of the guys her dad called talk show idiots. This one was a sports talk show idiot. Could it be raining in Boston? Game canceled, empty seats? Tarp on the field? Tricia looked doubtfully up at her piece of the sky, where the first stars were now shining like sequins on dark blue velvet. There would be a zillion of them before long. She couldn't see so much as a single cloud. Of course, she was 150 miles from Boston, maybe more, but... The talk show idiot was on the line with Walt from Framingham. Walt was on his car phone. When the talk show idiot asked where he was now, Walt from Framingham said,
"Somewhere in Danvers, Mike."
Pronouncing the town's name as Massachusetts people all did, Danvers, making it sound like not a town but something you'd drink to settle an upset tummy. "Lost in the woods, been drinking straight from the stream and shitting your brains out as a result? A tablespoon of Danvers and you'll feel better fast." Walt from Framingham wanted to know why Tom Gordon always pointed to the sky when he got a save. "You know, Mike, that pointin' thing," was how Walt put it. And Mike, the talk show sports idiot, explained it was number 36's way of thanking God.
"He ought to point to Joe Kerrigan instead," Walt from Framingham said. "It was Kerrigan's idea to turn him into a closer. As a starter, he was for the birds, you know? Maybe God gave Kerrigan the idea. Did you ever think of that, Walt?"
talk show idiot asked.
"Joe Kerrigan being the Red Sox pitching coach, for those of you who might not know."
"I do know, numwit," Tricia murmured impatiently.
We're mostly talking Sox tonight while the Sox enjoy a rare night off,
said Mike, the talk show idiot.
They open a 3-game set with Oakland tomorrow. Yes, West Coast, here we come, and you'll hear all the action here on WEEI. But today, it's an open date.
An open date. That explained it. Tricia felt an absurdly huge disappointment weigh her down, and more tears, in Danvis you called them tiz, began to form in her eyes. She cried so easily now. Now she cried over anything. But she had been looking forward to the game, damn it. Hadn't known how much she needed the voices of Joe Castiglione and Jerry Trupiano until she found out she wouldn't be hearing them.
We've got some open lines,
the talk show idiot said.
Let's fill them up. Anybody out there think Mo Vaughn ought to stop acting like a kid and just sign on the dotted line? How much Mo money does this guy need anyway? Good question, isn't it?
It's a stupid question, El Dopo, Tricia said pettishly. If you could hit like Mo, you'd ask for a lot of money, too.
Want to talk about marvelous Pedro Martinez? Darren Lewis, the surprising Sox bullpen? A nice surprise from the Red Sox, can you believe it? Give me a call. Tell me what you think. Back after this.
A happy voice began singing a familiar jingle.
Who do you call when your windshield's busted?
1-800-54-GIANT, Tricia said, and then dialed away from EEI. Maybe she could find another game. Even the hated Yankees would do. But before she found any baseball, she was transfixed by the sound of her own name.
Is fading for 9-year-old Patricia McFarland missing since Saturday morning?
The news announcer voice was faint, wavery, sliced and diced by static. Tricia leaned forward, her fingers going to her ears and pressing the little black buds deeper in.
Connecticut law enforcement authorities, acting on a tip phoned in to state police in Maine, today arrested Francis Raymond Mazzaroli of Weymouth, Massachusetts, and questioned him for 6 hours in connection with the McFarland girl's disappearance. Mazzaroli, a construction worker currently employed on a Hartford Bridge project, has twice been convicted of child molestation and is being held pending extradition to Maine on current charges of sexual assault and child molestation there. It now seems that he has no knowledge of Patricia McFarland's whereabouts, however. A source close to the investigation says that Mazzaroli claims to have been in Hartford over the past weekend and that numerous witnesses corroborate.
The sound faded out. Tricia pushed the power button and pulled the earbuds out of her ears. Were they still looking for her? They probably were, but she had an idea that they'd spent most of the day hanging around that guy Mazzaroli instead. What a bunch of El Dopos, she said disconsolately, and returned her Walkman to her pack. She lay back on the pine boughs, spread her poncho over her, then shuffled her shoulders and butt around until she was close to comfortable. A breeze puffed past, and she was glad she was in one of the hammocky dips between the rock outcrops. It was chilly tonight, and would probably be downright cold before the sun came up. Overhead in the black were a zillion stars just as forecast. Exactly 1 zillion. They would pale a bit when the moon rose, but for now they were bright enough to paint her dirty cheeks with frost. As always, Tricia wondered if any of those brilliant specks were warming other live beings. Were there jungles out there populated by fabulous alien animals? Pyramids? Kings and giants? Possibly even some version of baseball? Who do you call when your windshield's busted? Tricia sang softly. 1-800-54. She broke off, drawing swift breath in over her lower lip, as if hurt. White fire scratched the sky as one of the stars fell. The streak ran halfway across the black, then winked out. Not a star, of course. Not a real star, but a meteor. There was another, and then another. Tricia sat up, the split rags of her poncho falling into her lap, her eyes wide. Here was a fourth and a fifth, these going in a different direction, not just a meteor, but a meteor shower. As if something had only been waiting for her to understand this, the sky lit up in a silent storm of bright contrails. Tricia stared, neck tilted, eyes wide, arms crossed over her breastless chest, hands clutching her shoulders with nervous, nail-bitten fingers. She had never seen anything like it, never dreamed there could be anything like it. Oh, Tom, she whispered in a trembling voice. Oh, Tom, look at this. Do you see? Most were momentary white flashes, thin and straight and gone so quickly They would have seemed like hallucinations if there hadn't been so many of them. A few, however, 5, perhaps 8, lit up the sky like silent fireworks, brilliant stripes that seemed to burn orange at the edges. That orange might just have been eye dazzle, but Tricia didn't think so. At last the shower began to wane. Tricia lay back again and scooted the various sore parts of her body around some more until she was comfortable again. As comfortable as she was apt to get anyway. As she did, she watched the ever more occasional flashes as bits of rock further off the path than she could ever get dropped into the Earth's well of gravity, first turning red as the atmosphere thickened, and then burning to death in brief glares of light. Tricia was still watching when she fell asleep. Her dreams were vivid, but fragmentary, a kind of mental meteor shower. The only one she remembered with any clarity was the one she had been having just before she woke up in the middle of the night, coughing and cold, lying on her side with her knees drawn all the way up to her chin and shivering all over. In this dream, she and Tom Gordon were in an old meadow, which was now running to bushes and young trees, mostly birches. Tom was standing by a splintery post that came up to about the height of his hip. On top of it was an old ring bolt, rusty red. Tom was flicking this back and forth between his fingers. He was wearing his warm-up jacket over his uniform, the gray road uniform. He would be in Oakland tonight. She had asked Tom about that pointin' thing. She knew, of course, but asked anyway. Possibly because Walt from Framingham had wanted to know, in a cellular El Dopo like Walt wouldn't believe any little girl lost in the woods. Walt would want it straight from the closer's mouth. I point because it's God's nature to come in on the bottom of the ninth, Tom said. He spun the ring bolt on the top of the post back and forth between his fingers. Back and forth, back and forth. Who do you call when your ring bolt's busted? Dial 1-800-54-RING-BOLT, of course. Especially when the bases are loaded and there's only one out. Something in the woods chattered at that, perhaps in derision. The chattering grew louder and louder until Tricia opened her eyes in the dark and realized it was the sound of her own teeth. She got slowly to her feet, wincing as every part of her body protested. Her legs were the worst, closely followed by her back. A gust of wind struck her, not a puff this time, but a gust, and almost knocked her over. She wondered how much weight she had lost. A week of this and you'll be able to put a string around me and fly me like a kite, she thought. She started to laugh at that, and the laugh turned into another coughing fit. She stood with her hands planted on her legs just above her knees, her head down, coughing. The cough started deep in her chest and came out of her mouth in a series of harsh barks. Great. Just great. She put the inside of her wrist to her forehead and couldn't tell if she had a fever or not. Walking slowly with her legs spread far apart, her butt chafed less when she did that, Tricia went back to the pines and broke off more branches, this time meaning to pile them on top of her like blankets. She took one armload back to her bed, got a second, and stopped halfway between the trees and the needle-floored dip she'd chosen to sleep in. Slowly, she turned in a complete circle under the blazing 4 o'clock stars. "Leave me alone, can't you?" she cried. And that started her coughing again. When she got the cough under control, she said it again, but in a lower voice. "Can't you quit it? Can't you just cut me a break? Let me be." Nothing. No sound but the soughing of the wind through the pines. And then a grunt, low and soft, not even remotely human. Tricia stood where she was with her arms around her fragrant, sappy load of branches. Her skin broke out in little hard bumps. Where had that grunt come from? The side of the stream? The other side? From the stand of pines? She had a horrible idea, almost a certainty, that it was the pines. The thing which had been watching her was in the pines. As she harvested branches to cover herself with, its face had been perhaps less than 3 feet from her own. Its claws, the ones which had torn into the trees and ripped both deer apart, had perhaps hovered within inches of her own hands as she bent the branches back and forth, first splintering them, and then breaking them. Tricia started coughing again, and that got her moving.
She dropped the branches in a helter-skelter pile and crawled among them without any attempt to create order out of their jumbled chaos. She winced and moaned a little when one of them poked the place on her hip where she had been stung, then lay still. She sensed it coming now, slipping out of the pines and finally coming for her. The tough Tootsie's special thing, the wasp priest's god of the lost. You could call it whatever you wanted. The lord of dark places, the emperor of understairs, every kid's worst nightmare. Whatever it was, it had finished teasing her. It was all done playing games. It would simply tear away the branches beneath which she was cowering and eat her alive. Coughing and shivering, all sense of reality and rationality gone. Temporarily insane, in fact. Trisha put her arms over the back of her head and simply waited to be torn open by the thing's claws and stuffed into its fangy mouth. She fell asleep that way, and when she woke in the early light of Tuesday morning, both of her arms were asleep from the elbows down, and at first she couldn't bend her neck at all. She had to walk with her head down and cocked slightly to one side.
"I guess I won't have to ask either Grandma what it's like to be old," she thought as she squatted to pee. "I guess that now I know."
As she walked back to the pile of branches where she had slept, like a chipmunk in a burrow, she thought wryly. She saw that one of the other needle-filled hammocks, the one nearest hers, in fact, looked disturbed. The needles had been sprayed around and dug right down to the thin black earth in one place. So maybe she hadn't been insane in the dark of early morning after all. Or not entirely insane, because later on, after she'd gone back to sleep, something had come. It had been right next to her, perhaps squatting and watching her sleep, wondering if it should take her now, and finally deciding not to, deciding to let her ripen for at least one more day, to let her sweeten like a checkerberry. Trisha turned in a circle, feeling a dim sense of déjà vu, but not remembering she had turned exactly the same circle in almost exactly the same place only a few hours ago. She stopped when she came back to where she had started, coughing nervously into her hand. The cough made her chest hurt, a small, dull pain that was very deep inside. She didn't exactly mind. The pain was warm, at least, and every other part of her felt cold this morning.
"It's gone, Tom," she said. "Whatever it is, it's gone again. For a little while, anyway."
"Yes," Tom said, "but it'll be back, and sooner or later, you'll have to deal with it."
"Let the evil of the day be sufficient thereof," Trisha said.
That was one of her Grandma McFarlane's. She didn't know exactly what it meant, but thought she sort of knew, and it seemed to fit this occasion. She sat on a rock beside her hammock and munched three big handfuls of berries and beech nuts, telling herself it was granola. The berries weren't as tasty this morning, a little tough, in fact, and Trisha guessed they would be even less tasty come lunchtime. Still, she made herself eat all three handfuls, then went to the stream for a drink. She saw another of those little trout in it, and although the ones she'd seen so far weren't much bigger than smelts or large sardines, she suddenly decided to try and catch one. The stiffness had begun working out of her body a little. The day was warming as the sun rose, and she had begun to feel a little better. Hopeful, almost. Maybe lucky, too. Even the cough had eased. Trisha went back to her tangled bed, extracted the remains of her poor old poncho, and spread it on one of the rock outcrops. She hunted for a stone with a sharp edge, and found a good one near the place where the stream tumbled over the rounded lip of the bluff and into the valley below. This slope was easily as steep as the one she'd gone sliding down on the day she had gotten lost. That day seemed at least 5 years ago to Trisha. But she thought it would be a much easier descent. There were lots of trees to hold on to. Trisha took her improvised cutting tool back to her poncho, spread on the rock like that. The poncho looked like a big blue paper doll, and sawed the hood off below the shoulder line. She doubted very much if she could actually catch a fish in the hood, but it would be amusing to try, and she didn't feel like trying the slope until she had limbered up a little bit more. She sang softly under her breath as she worked. First the Boys to the Max song that had been in her head throughout, then the Hansons' Mmm-bop, then a snatch of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Mostly, however, she sang the one that went, "Who do you call when your windshield's busted?"
The chilly breeze of the night before had kept the worst of the bugs away, but as the day heated up, the usual cloud of tiny airshow performers coalesced around Trisha's head. She barely noticed them, giving an occasional impatient wave when they got too close to her eyes. Only when she had finished cutting the hood off the poncho, she held it upside down, dangling it and studying it with a critical, judicious eye. Interesting. Undoubtedly too stupid to work, but sort of interesting just the same.
Who do you call, baby? Who do you call when the damn thing's busted? Oh, yeah,
Trisha chanted in a sing-songy whisper and walked over to the stream. She picked out two rocks protruding side by side from the water and planted her feet on them. She gazed down between her spread legs into the rushing current. The stream's pebble-packed bed was wavery but otherwise clear. No fish right now, but so what? If you wanted to be a fisher girl, you had to be patient.
Put your arms around me, 'cause I got a munch on you,
Trisha sang, then laughed. Pretty goofy. Holding the hood upside down by the ragged shoulder material, she bent and dropped her improvised snare into the stream. The current pulled the hood back between her legs, but it stayed open, so that was all right. The problem was her position. Back bent, butt in the air, head at the level of her waist. She wouldn't be able to hold this pose long, and if she tried to squat on the rocks, her sore, shaky legs would likely betray her and send her tumbling into the stream. A full-body dunk wouldn't help her cough. When her temples started to thud, Trisha compromised by bending her knees and lifting her upper body a little. This shifted her eyeline upstream, and she saw three quicksilver flashes. They were fish, all right, there was no doubt, coming toward her. If she'd had time to react, Trisha almost certainly would have jerked the hood and caught none of them. As it was, she had time for only a single thought.
Like underwater shooting stars.
And then the silver glints were zipping between the rocks she was standing on and right beneath her. One of them missed the hood, but the other two swam right into it.
Boya! Trish screamed.
With that cry, it was as much dismay and shock as joy. Trisha bent forward again and grasped the lower edge of the hood. In doing so, she almost overbalanced and went into the stream anyway, but she managed to stay up. She lifted the hood, full of water and slopping over the sides, in both hands. It shifted out of shape as she stepped back to the bank, and more water slopped out, soaking the left leg of her jeans from hip to knee. One of the little trout went with it, twisting and flipping its tail in the air, then hitting the water and swimming away.
Sugar tit,
Trisha screamed. But now she was also laughing. As she worked her way up the bank, still holding the hood in front of her, she began coughing as well. When she reached a level place, she looked into the hood. Sure, she would see nothing. She had lost the other fish as well, must have. Girls didn't catch trout, even baby ones, in the hoods of their ponchos. She just hadn't seen its getaway. But the trout was still there, swimming around like a molly in a goldfish bowl.
God, what do I do now?
Trisha asked. This was a genuine prayer, both agonized and bemused. It was her body that answered, not her spirit. She had seen plenty of cartoons where Wile E. Coyote looked at Roadrunner and saw him turn into Thanksgiving dinner. She had laughed, Pete laughed, even Mom laughed if she was watching. Trisha did not laugh now. Berries and beechnuts the size of sunflower seeds were all very well, but they weren't enough. Even when you ate them together and told yourself they were granola, they weren't enough. Her body's reaction to the 4-inch trout swimming in the blue hood was radically different. Not hunger exactly, but a kind of clench, a cramp that centered in her belly, but actually came from everywhere. An inarticulate cry,
"Give me that,"
which had little to do with her brain. It was a trout, just a little one far below the legal limit, but whatever her eyes saw, her body saw dinner. Real dinner. Trisha had only one clear thought as she took the hood over to the remains of the poncho, which was still spread on the outcrop. A paper doll with a head now.
I'll do it, but I'll never, ever talk about it. If they find me, rescue me, I'll tell them everything except how I fell into my own shit. And this.
She acted with no planning or consideration. Her body brushed her mind aside and simply took over. Trisha spilled the contents of the hood onto the needle-covered ground and watched this little fishy flop about, strangling in the air. When it was still, she picked it up, put it on the poncho, and slid it up the belly with the stone she'd used to cut off the poncho's hood. A thimbleful of watery, mucousy fluid ran out, more like thin snot than blood. Inside the fish, she could see tiny red guts. These Tricia levered out with a grimy thumbnail. Beyond them was a bone. She tried to pull it free and got about half of it. During all this, her mind tried to take over only once. "You can't eat the head," it told her, its reasonable tone not really masking the horror and disgust beneath. "I mean, the eyes, Tricia. The eyes." Then her body brushed it away again, and more roughly this time. "When I want your opinion, I'll rattle the bars in your cage," Pepsi sometimes said. Tricia picked up the small flayed fish by the tail, carried it back to the stream, and dipped it to get rid of the pine needles and grime. Then she cocked her head back, opened her mouth, and bit off the trout's top half. Small bones crunched under her teeth. Her mind tried to show her the trout's eyes popping out of its head and onto her tongue in little dark dabs of jelly. She got one blurry look at this, and then her body banished her mind yet again, this time slapping instead of merely pushing. Mind would come back when mind was needed. Imagination could come back when imagination was needed. Right now, body was in charge, and body said dinner. It's dinner. "It may be morning, but dinner is served, and this morning we got fresh fish." The trout's top half went down her throat like a big swallow of oil with lumps in it. The taste was horrible, and also wonderful. It tasted like life. Trish dangled the trout's dripping lower half in front of her upturned face, pausing only long enough to pull another piece of bone out of it, whispering, "Dial 1-800-54. Fresh fish." She ate the rest of the trout, tail and all. When it was down, she stood looking across the stream, wiping her mouth and wondering if she was going to puke it all back up again. She had eaten raw fish, and although the taste of it was still coating her throat, she could hardly believe it. Her stomach gave a funny little lurch, and Tricia thought, "This is it." Then she burped and her stomach settled again. She took her hand away from her mouth and saw a few fish scales gleaming on the palm. She wiped them on her jeans with a grimace, then walked back to where her pack lay. She stuffed the remains of her poncho in the severed hood, which had turned out to work pretty well, at least on the fish that were young and stupid, into it, on top of her food supply, then re-shouldered the pack. She felt strong, ashamed of herself, proud of herself, feverish, and a little nutsoid. I won't talk about it, that's all. I don't have to talk about it, and I won't, even if I get out of here. "And I deserve to get out," Tricia said softly. "Anyone who can eat a raw fish deserves to get out." "The Japanese do it all the time," said the tough Tootsie, as Tricia set out once more along the side of the stream. "So I'll tell them," Tricia said. "If I ever get over there for a visit, I'll tell them." For once, the tough Tootsie seemed to have no comeback. Tricia was delighted. She made her way carefully down the slope and into the valley, where her stream bowled along through a forest of mixed firs and deciduous trees. These were thickly packed, but there was less underbrush and fewer bramble patches, and for most of the morning, Tricia got along well. There was no sense of being watched, and eating the fish had revitalized her strength. She pretended that Tom Gordon was walking with her, and they had a long and interesting conversation, mostly about Tricia. Tom wanted to know all about her, it seemed. Her favorite classes at school, why she thought Mr. Hall was mean for giving homework on Fridays, all the ways Deborah Gilhooly had of being such a bitch, how she and Pepsi had planned to go trick-or-treating as Spice Girls last Halloween, and Mom had said Pepsi's mom could do whatever she wanted, but no 9-year-old girl of hers was going out trick-or-treating in a short skirt, high heels, and a cami top. Tom sympathized completely with Trisha's utter embarrassment. She was telling him about how she and Pete were planning to get their dad a custom-made jigsaw puzzle for his birthday from this company in Vermont that made them. Or if that was too expensive, they would settle for a weed whacker. When she stopped suddenly, stopped moving, stopped talking. She studied the stream for almost a full minute, the corners of her mouth drooping, one hand waving automatically at the cloud of bugs around her head. The underbrush was creeping back in among the trees now. The trees themselves were stuntier, the light brighter. Crickets hummed and sang.
No, Tricia said. No, No way, not again.
The stream's new quietness was what had first distracted her from her fascinating conversation with Tom Gordon. Pretend people were such good listeners. The stream no longer babbled and brawled. That was because the speed of its current had slowed. Its bed was weedier than it had been above the valley's floor. It was beginning to spread out.
If it goes into another swamp, I'll kill myself, Tom.
An hour later, Tricia pushed her way wearily through a snarl of mixed poplars and birches, raised the heel of her hand to her forehead to crush a particularly troublesome mosquito, and then just left it there, hand to brow. The image of every human in history who is exhausted and doesn't know what to do or where to turn. At some point, the stream had spilled over its low banks and drowned a large area of open land, creating a shallow marsh of reeds and cattails. Between them, the sun glittered on standing water in hot pricks of light. Crickets hummed, frogs croaked. Overhead, two hawks cruised on stiff wings. Somewhere, a crow was laughing. The marsh didn't look nasty, like the bog of hummocks and drowned deadwood she'd waded through, but it stretched for at least a mile, and probably two, before coming to a low, pine-covered ridge. And the stream, of course, was gone. Tricia sat down on the ground, started to say something to Tom Gordon, and realized how stupid it was to be pretending when it was clear, and growing clearer with every passing hour, that she was going to die. It didn't matter how much walking she did or how many fish she managed to catch and choke down. She began to cry. She put her face in her hands, sobbing harder and harder.
I want my mother,
she yelled at the indifferent day. The hawks were gone, but over by that wooded ridge, the crow was still laughing.
I want my mother. I want my brother. I want my dolly. I want to go home.
The frogs only croaked, reminding her of some story Dad had read her when she was little, a car stuck in the mud and all the frogs croaking too deep, too deep. How that had frightened her. She cried harder still, and at some point her tears, all these gosh damn tears, made her angry. She looked up, bugs spinning all around her, the hateful tears still spilling down her mucky face.
I want my mother! I want my brother! I want to get out of here! I want to get out of here! Do you hear me?
She kicked her legs up and down, kicked them so hard that one of her sneakers flew off. She knew she was doing a full-fledged tantrum now, the first one since she'd been 5 or 6, and didn't care. She threw herself onto her back, pounded her fists, then opened them so she could tear handfuls of grass out of the ground and throw them into the air.
Find me, you stupid puppy shit assholes! Why don't you find me? I want to go home!
She lay looking up at the sky, panting. Her stomach hurt, and her throat was sore from screaming, but she felt a little bit better, as if she'd gotten rid of something dangerous. She put an arm over her face and dozed off, still sniffling. When she woke up, the sun was over the ridge on the far side of the marsh. It was afternoon again. Tell me, Johnny, what do we have for our contestants? Well, Bob, we have another afternoon. It's not much of a prize, but I guess it's the best a bunch of puppy-shit assholes like us can do. Trisha's head swam when she sat up. A squadron of large black moths unfolded their wings and went flying lazily across her field of vision. For a moment, she was sure she was going to faint. The feeling passed, but her throat was still sore when she swallowed, and her head felt hot. Shouldn't have slept in the sun, she told herself. Except sleeping in the sun wasn't the reason she felt this way. The reason was that she was getting sick. Tricia put on the sneaker she had kicked off doing her stupid tantrum, then ate a handful of berries and drank some stream water from the bottle. She spied a cluster of fiddleheads growing at the edge of the marsh and ate them too. They were fading and a lot tougher than they were tasty, but she forced them down. With high tea over, she stood up and looked across the marsh again, this time shading her eyes from the sun. After a moment, she shook her head slowly and wearily, the gesture of a woman instead of a child, and an old woman at that. She could see the ridge clearly, and she was sure it was dry over there, but she couldn't face slogging through another quagmire with her Reeboks tied around her neck. Not even if this one was shallower than the other one and not as nasty underfoot. Not for all the late spring fiddleheads in the world. Why should she, with no stream to follow? She was as apt to find help or another stream in another easier direction. So thinking, Tricia turned fully north, walking along the east side of the marsh that sprawled across most of the valley's floor. She had done a great many things right since becoming lost, more than she ever would have guessed. But this was a bad decision, the worst she'd made since leaving the path in the first place. Had she crossed the marsh and climbed the ridge, she would have found herself looking down at Devlin Pond on the outskirts of Green Mount, New Hampshire. Devlin was small, but there were cottages on its south end and a camp road leading out to New Hampshire Route 52. On a Saturday or Sunday, Tricia would almost certainly have heard the burr of powerboats on the pond as weekenders towed kids on water skis. After the 4th of July, there would have been powerboats out there on any day of the week, sometimes so many that they had to weave to avoid each other. But this was midweek in early June. There was no one out on Devlin but a couple of fishermen with little 20-horse putt-putts, and Tricia consequently heard nothing but the birds and the frogs and the bugs. Instead of finding the pond, she turned toward the Canadian border and began walking deeper into the woods. Some 400 miles ahead was Montreal. Between it and her, not much.